This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The financial system helped trigger the most severe economic recession in 70 years. Against this backdrop, the U.S. Department of the Treasury continues to pursue effectively managing U.S. government finances and promoting the nation's security by strengthening international financial systems. Managing its resources efficiently and effectively is key to Treasury successfully achieving these goals. How is Treasury promoting management organizational excellence? What is Treasury doing to implement financial reforms? And how is Treasury leveraging technology and innovation to be more efficient and effective? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Dan Tenglerini, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Management and Chief Financial Officer. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks for having me on.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Roxanne Ulrich. Welcome, Roxanne.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Dan, before we delve into a specific initiative, I want to learn more about your organization. Would you briefly give us an overview of the history, mission, and continued evolution of the Treasury Department?
So the history of the Treasury Department, I don't think we have enough time to go through the history of the Treasury Department. I had the great pleasure to hear a conversation with Ron Chernow yesterday, and he wrote this great book about Alexander Hamilton. So if you really want to know the history of the Treasury Department, suggest picking that up. It's a great way of learning about how the department has really sat at the corner of Maine and Maine, really, for our political history in the United States. Third longest occupied federal office building, the Maine Treasury Building, after the White House and the Capitol. And in a sense, the Treasury Department really represents the ongoing political dialogue of our nation. It's agrarianism versus mercantilism. It's issues about big government or states' rights. Even the two statues on either end of the Treasury main building, the statue of Gallatin, the statue of Hamilton, represents this big dichotomy and this ongoing discussion. Everything we're doing today, really, in the political discourse has been this long-term political discourse that we've had here in the country. It's part of the beating of the heart, the political heart of the country, and the Treasury Department sits right there at the intersection of that. And so the Treasury Department's history is not one I could do justice to in a few minutes. It's one that's really fascinating and well worth delving into. In fact, just yesterday, someone brought a copy to me of the public accounts for 1842. And this is a great little, it's essentially the budget from 1842. It's our general ledger of the United States government. And it goes into, you know, President Tyler's salary here, $25,002, and just the thought that we sit in that building and we work on these issues that we've worked on since the founding of this country, and we're asking a lot of these same questions, and in many ways that's really kind of the history and the mission of the Treasury Department distilled, is how do we provide that kind of economic environment for the country to continue to succeed. And the story and the history of the country is so intertwined with this department that it's just a tremendous honor and great pleasure to get to work there.
So with such a critical mission, I'd like to understand the operational footprint of Treasury. Would you tell us more about how it's organized, the size of its budget, number of employees, and its geographical footprint?
Right. The Treasury Department does everything from, you know, starting with Secretary Geithner, serving as the president's kind of main advisor on issues economic, to providing the basic services of a going economy, such as coinage and bills. You know, we have the Mint, we have the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. We pay all the bills for the federal government through the Financial Management Service. We issue the debt of the federal government through our Bureau of Public Debt. We're a central headquarters-based cabinet agency that has about 9 bureaus. We have 3 programs, the Office of Financial Stability, the Community Development Financial Institutions Program, and our newest kind of component, which we're about to spin off on July 21st, which is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And then because what we deal with is so important, so consequential, and deals with so much, frankly, resources, we have 3 IGs. We have the Treasury Inspector General, we have the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, or TIGTA, and then we have the special IG for our TARP program, the SIGTARP. So the Treasury Department, it's $23 billion in total mandatory and appropriate resources. About 14.7 of that is domestic discretionary appropriations. 13.3 billion of that is IRS alone. So the rest of the Treasury Department is collapsed into about $1.4 billion in appropriations. But it represents 116,000, at least in our FY12 budget request, 116,000 full-time equivalent federal employees spread throughout the entire, every one of the 50 states, and about 20 countries as well. We have representation through Treasury attachés and through IRS criminal investigators in about 20 countries outside the United States as well.
A wonderful overview of the history, the rich history of the department and its operational footprint. But I want to switch a little bit to what you do. You have a tremendous portfolio in terms of its breadth and depth. You are the Assistant Secretary for Management, the Chief Information Officer, and I understand the Chief Performance Officer.
Right.
Would you give us an overview of what those roles and responsibilities entail, and how do you support the overall mission of the organization?
The job has 2 formal appointments as the Assistant Secretary of Management and the Chief Financial Officer. And really what my office does is provide resources for the entire department. Those are financial resources, human capital resources, contractual resources, and technological resources. We also then focus on things like small business participation, records and information management, and then just the operations of the departmental offices. Departmental offices is about 1,700 people, $300 million program. It's its own little kind of city unto itself, and we have to provide everything from the food service to the mail pickup, the heat and light in the building, the main Treasury building, which we own and manage on our own. So my office is this great combination of wholesale in doing, you know, the budget for the Treasury Department, the financial statements of the Treasury Department, which include all the assets and liabilities of the federal government. We roll them up. And then retail. And that means literally retail in the form of the cafeteria in the main Treasury Department building. So I joke, if I can't get any traction on the wholesale, I can go down and worry about the menu in the basement of the main Treasury building. So.
Dan, regarding your responsibilities and duties, what do you view as the top 3 challenges that you face, and how have you addressed those, or how will you looking forward?
So all 3 of our top challenges, I would just condense into the one big issue that we've been dealing with as a department, and that's the global financial crisis. And frankly, for us, our job is in providing the resources and the support and the systems and the structures for the department to contend with that, to contend with, you know, the early on issues of trying to grapple with it, turn it around, and then our efforts now to continue to foster the recovery and stabilize the recovery and push economic growth. And so really our job is to support those incredible, hardworking, smart people in the Department of Treasury who are pushing forward on the administration's efforts, our collective efforts, frankly, to improve the economy.
And would you describe your career path for our listeners? And how did you really begin your career and get to where you are today?
That's a question that I think my mom is constantly asking, how did this happen? But my first job in government was a summer youth job up in Massachusetts, fixing potholes with the Massachusetts Department of Public Works, their highways, mass highways, picking up dead animals off the side of the street, trash on the at highway intersections and filling potholes. So in many ways, I think a lot of the work I do is still at a very operational level, still at the fixing potholes level. And it's really about finding ways that government can provide excellent customer service, that we can provide those necessary and sometimes not always easy and not always attractive kind of basic responsibilities and duties. after going to graduate school at the University of Chicago, I won a presidential management internship. I worked at OMB for 6 years, USDOT for a year. Secretary Slater loaned me to the city. It was just supposed to be a 3-month detail. 10 years later, after being the transportation director, well, before that, the CFO of the police department, some time at Metro, and then the city administrator, I find myself back kind of where I started, on the other side of the White House now, at the Treasury Department, working on potholes and trash cleanup of federal government management issues.
Well, given that rich experience, I want to get a sense of, from your perspective, what makes an effective leader? What are the characteristics of an effective leader? And more importantly, what management lessons have you learned and brought to the culture at Treasury?
Well, that's a great question. I think you have to recognize as a leader, you know, the definition is that you're leading people. And I think that, frankly, if you recognize that you can't do anything without great people, and if you can't, you can't get anything done unless you support those people, that it really starts with who you have the honor and the pleasure to be responsible for being in charge of. And so working with the tremendous people, and that's been the great opportunity at the Treasury Department, is just how many smart, talented, dedicated, focused people there are at that department, all with great ideas, all who come with a desire to play the best possible game and deliver the best possible results. How do you capture that knowledge, that experience, that passion, that interest, and turn it towards the project you're working on? I think the key is to find great role models, and Secretary Geithner, Deputy Secretary Wolin, these are folks who really have a very, very high standard and are really trying to push us to be as good as we possibly can be, because this is a real important time for Treasury in this country, and we need to be, you know, the best possible department.
How is Treasury managing implementation of key financial reforms? We will ask Dan Tenglerini, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Management and Chief Financial Officer, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can government cut costs and improve performance? What are federal agencies doing to be more transparent, participatory, and innovative? How is the Navy strengthening its information dominance for the 21st century? What is the U.S. Postal Service doing to reduce its carbon footprint and green its operations? And how are state and local governments doing more with less? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dan Tenglerini, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Management and Chief Financial Officer. Also joining us from IBM is Roxanne Ulrich. Dan, the Department of the Treasury established 3 priority performance goals that seek to drive its focus and achieve measurable results. Would you tell us more about Treasury's top 3 performance goals?
Sure. Our top 3 challenges in management are the global financial crisis. Number 1 in our high priority goals is repairing and reforming the financial system and really expanding economic opportunity as kind of a related component to that. The next is increasing voluntary compliance in our tax system. And then also as part of that, simplifying the tax code. I'm working to, you know, improve the tax code and continually focusing on efforts to make voluntary compliance an easier default location. The final one is increasing our paperless transactions. And in many ways, these 3 kind of high priority goals reflect the 3 kind of levels that we work at. One, the Treasury Department works at this national and international level, where we have an oversight relationship, we have a policy relationship with our global economic and financial system and structure. And so what we're trying to do is, recognizing the crisis that we've just come through, that we need to put in place those protections that minimize the likelihood of that happening again, reducing the impact of financial shocks, and bringing the world together closer to recognizing a global economy that we have to work together on these issues, while at the same time improving and enhancing our national security and minimizing people's ability to use the global financial system for untoward outcomes. The next level, the increasing voluntary tax compliance, really deals with how Treasury interacts with the American public directly as a service provider, as an organization that interacts at a fundamental level with people, providing this very core service, which is the tax collection, which is not just putting the fuel in the tank of government so that we can continue to provide all the services of government, but also it's designed to encourage and discourage certain investments and types of behaviors. And so what we want to do is make sure that we're constantly working on that system to make it fairer, to make it easier, working with the IRS to improve, say, their website, increase the e-filing rates, improve the quality of preparers. So that's the next level. And then the third one, the increasing paperless transactions, is really about the wiring diagram, the bones, the systems of the Treasury Department itself, and saying that we have a responsibility to really improve the way the Treasury Department operates at a fundamental level. And one of the ways we want to get at that is ask ourselves, what are those business processes we employ? How do we do stuff? And can we set as kind of a common metric, could we reduce the amount of paper we're moving around, paper being a proxy, frankly, for inefficiency?
Well, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act represents the most sweeping financial reforms since the Great Depression. Would you give us an overview of your role, meaning the Treasury's role, in implementing a lot of the requirements associated with this act?
So the Dodd-Frank bill is an incredibly important and historic piece of legislation. And what it does is, in part, it's an effort to try to bring the financial regulators together and get them to continually interact and work with each other on issues of systemic risk and ask the question, you know, what is happening within our financial system across the various different specialties of financial regulation so that we can get a better global picture of what's taking place. One of the core provisions of that is something called the Financial Stabilization Oversight Council, or FSOC, chaired by the Secretary of Treasury, and then, you know, peopled by all the core or key regulators, including representatives of state insurance regulators, which is a very kind of new component to the way the federal government is interacting with the financial system. Insurance has generally been a state issue. FSOC then would be supported by the Office of Financial Research, which is really supposed to be this intellectual research arm that's looking at, you know, being asked questions by the FSOC and then answering them through strong data and building relations with the financial community, building relations with the regulators to try to pick up trends or try to expose weaknesses and have a back and forth between the FSOC about what they can do to, you know, build stronger regulation, or if the regulation is impeding competition or if it's limiting innovation. So to really provide meaningful kind of support and research to the FSOC. Another key component of the Dodd-Frank is the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. And Treasury's job is to get that thing going, to start it up and let it take off. Elizabeth Warren is leading that effort, and that's trying to make sure that the financial system that has gotten so broad and complicated is not so complicated that an average American can get overtaken by those complications, to try to make it fairer, try to make it more transparent, trying to make it clearer, make it more honest, and really, you know, give people somewhere where they can go if they have concerns, if they have questions. Education is a big part of its mission as well. Great new person there, Holly Petraeus, is going to work with our American service members to help them navigate the financial system, help learn ways that we can make it more transparent and easier for them to deal with the system. We have an office we have to stand up related to students and to the elderly. So that is kind of the part of the Dodd-Frank bill that people are probably going to see the most, feel and touch, and to try to create some way that we can kind of create a fair environment in which people get to interact with this huge component of our economy.
Changing direction a little bit, looking at the 2012 budget, Dan, how has the budget passed back, as well as the recent call to freeze domestic spending, influence how you intend to accomplish objectives and prioritize your key initiatives?
Well, I think the 2012 budget has just reiterated the focus that we have to have as the Treasury Department anyway. Deputy Secretary Wolin has started this quarterly review process that we bring all our bureaus and policy offices through, and it's always had a focus on the resources that people have. What do we give you, and what do you do with what you got? With the idea being that the Treasury Department in particular has to have a high level of efficiency and a real focus on producing the most for the amount that gets put into it. And then asking the questions, are these really our priorities? Are these where we should be spending limited resources? And so the 2012 budget is really an expression of something that we see as part of our broader mission as the Treasury Department anyway. And the Secretary sees as one of his missions within the federal government is to constantly push on efficiency and effectiveness of programs so that people feel very comfortable when they make that payment to us through the IRS. They feel like it's going to a good place and it's going to be doing good stuff. And we have to feel strongly about the quality of the service we're providing. So I think the 12 budget, the 11 budget before it, all the budgets we've worked on in this administration have really been about a continued focus for the Treasury Department on efficiency and effectiveness of service delivery.
Reducing improper payments seems to be very, very critical. We hear a lot about that recently. Would you tell us about the Treasury programs such as the Earned Income Tax Credit, which are more susceptible to improper payments?
Well, I think, you know, the Treasury Department, again, is kind of at the corner of Maine and Maine on this issue because of all the payments that we make on behalf of other agencies as well. And so we've had a few cases where we've been kind of the place where we've caught improper payments or where, you know, improper payments have come back to. And we recognize that we have a unique responsibility among federal agencies. That's why we're working closely with OMB. In the President's budget, there's a $10 million initiative to develop a do not pay list and a portal that actually makes sure that agencies aren't making payments to people who don't qualify for them. We're working hard to further develop the Treasury Offset Program to work with agencies around debt collection to enhance and improve our federal debt collection activities. If people owe the federal government money, we should be really making sure that they pay that money to the federal government. That I think everyone would agree would be an area that we can continue to emphasize. And then things like EITC, a lot of our tax credit programs, you know, the assumption is that you qualify. And so we pay based on that assumption, and then we come back and we audit. One of the interesting things about the quarterly reviews is we spend a lot of time talking with Commissioner Shulman, who is a really thoughtful and skilled manager. He thinks a lot about this stuff, and he's asking those great kind of efficiency 80-20 questions. Where do I get 80% of the bang for 20% of the effort? In talking with them, we realized that 70% of the EITC improper payments come from returns prepared by professional preparers. And so it's part of the IRS's efforts to get a better handle on who the professional preparers are, actually have some kind of testing and certification or registration of the professional preparers, or at least create some system of accountability, and then we can reduce things, at least a big chunk of things like improper EITC claims and other claims. So that's kind of where the this kind of disciplined process of really understanding how these errors happen, what's the data underlying them, and then what specific actions you can take to address what you uncover through that data. That's I think that's the exciting part of working on this stuff.
Well, I want to keep on the idea of exciting parts. So I talked about the creation of the Office of Financial Innovation and Transformation. And in particular, what's the mission of this office? But more specifically, what progress has been happening thus far in developing a standard electronic invoicing platform for the federal government?
So that's another opportunity, really, that I think was realized, at the nexus of OMB and Treasury, recognizing the OMB cross-agency, cross-cutting role, asking questions on the way we manage our financial management systems. Can we find opportunities that really leverage the size and the scale of the federal government to produce better results at a lower cost? And OFID is, again, this small office who's really trying to look at not just making investments in these big financial management transformation systems that seem to take many years, have a kind of a mixed record, I'll say generously, of success, and ask ourselves, what are those kind of smaller platform ways that we can integrate ourselves that get, you know, big buck returns, internet payment platform, the IPP, signing up vendors so that we actually make electronic payments to those vendors. That's another big population of paper checks that we cut. That will reduce the cost of just, you know, paying our vendors. But the more interesting component of it is if we can begin to combine the records, we can get a better set of spend patterns. We can understand who's buying what and from where. That then feeds into work that Jeff Zients is leading in trying to drive down the cost of contracting government-wide. And so OFIT is still new and young and early, but there's a lot of great stuff already, you know, in the kitchen that they're busy cooking up right now. And Treasury is excited about taking a leadership position as being an operating agency that actually implements this.
That's a nice transition into understanding Treasury's lead role in the Recovery Act and its success of the Recovery Act. Would you tell us more about your efforts of your office in managing, tracking, and reporting on the significant amount of monies that went out the door for the Recovery Act? And more importantly, what are some of the innovative business or tracking or reporting requirements from the Recovery Act that you could include in new operations at Treasury?
Well, I think the Recovery Act actually is really interesting in the work that was done in the administration around the Recovery Act is most interesting, not around the innovation, there's an awful lot of it, but around some of the core management practices that when exercised yielded great results. The fact is that the vice president would assemble his Recovery Act cabinet. There were accountable officials in each of the agencies. I had the good fortune of being the accountable official for the Treasury Department. And he would assemble us, and really, we would have homework we had to do for that meeting. We had goals that we had to meet for that meeting. And you didn't want to go to that meeting without having done your homework and met your goals. A couple of people made the mistake early on, and you know, you think, you know, this is the vice president, it's going to be very dignified, and it's going to be, and he's very dignified, but he's also very focused on this outcome. He had been deputized to deliver a Recovery Act set of programs at the highest possible quality, the lowest possible problems with it. We had the Recovery Act IG board, who was kind of, they were not going to let anyone get away with anything. Everything was going to be put up on the Recovery Act website. The RAP board was going to meet monthly, and they were going to try to find stuff. And so the IRS, I think, is a unsung hero for some of the things that they put in nearly overnight in terms of delivering some of the tax benefits of the Recovery Act. 42% of the Recovery Act went through the Treasury Department in the form of tax benefits and some of the other programs. I know there's a lot of debate about the relative merits. I happen to come down on the side that it was a great program, had some very, very positive consequential effects.
How is Treasury leveraging analytics and data to improve program performance? We will ask Dan Tenglerini, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Management and Chief Financial Officer, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How is the federal government leveraging award prizes to spur innovation and solve tough problems? Pick up the latest Senate report, Managing Innovation Prizes in Government, and find out. Drawing on such successful efforts like the Lunar Lander Challenge and DARPA's Grand Urban Challenges, this report offers practical insights and recommendations for the design, implementation, and evaluation of innovation prizes in government. You can order or download a free copy of Managing Innovation Prizes in Government and all Senate reports at businessofgovernment.org. Telework has been touted as a winning strategy for government. In fact, a study by the Telework Research Network claims potential savings of nearly $3.8 billion. In a recent IBM Center report, Implementing Telework, Lessons Learned for Four Federal Agencies, Professor Scott Obermeyer presents case studies of federal agencies who have successfully implemented telework in their organizations. You can order or download a free copy of this and all Center reports at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dan Tenglerini, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Management and Chief Financial Officer. Also joining us from IBM is Roxanne Ulrich. Dan, the department launched a new performance management process led by the Deputy Secretary and coordinated through his office. Would you tell us more about this process and the performance management framework you are using to drive performance, deliver on results, and improve the overall performance culture at Treasury?
I think this comes back to this core management responsibility, and that is to understand what it is you do, understand what the issues that the people who are focused on that work have, worry about the resources they have to get that done, set some goals, stretch goals, push people to see what they can, you know, how they can do more, how they can do it more efficiently, see if they can do it differently, see if they can do it in partnership with other people. And then, like the instructions on shampoo, lather, rinse, repeat. You come back, you come back, you come back, and ask, what did we get wrong? What did we get right? What should we do different? Mm-hmm. I think that that's really what we're trying to do, is create this sense that you're not going to get away with it. You know, you're going to, you can't hold your breath and hope for, you know, the transition of, you know, the endless kind of churn in the political class to overtake the concern. And what we're hoping actually to do with this is institutionalize this approach to managing the agency such that whoever's deputy secretary, whoever's ASM CFO, will just take it on faith that this is the way we do this in the Department of Treasury.
Are you using analytics and data more nowadays to improve performance?
Absolutely. The mistake people have is to think that performance management is about a dashboard, or it's about that it's just about the data. In fact, it's really about that strong relationship between the people who set executive direction and the people who discharge that responsibility. It's that accountability relationship. But in order to inform the people who have to set executive direction, the people who have to make decisions, you need good data and you need good analysis of that data. You need to be able to ask the questions like the improper payment question. What is generating? Where are most of the improper payments come from? And then create initiatives and activities that can then focus on those activities to try to reduce the number of improper payments as a result. So then you need to have good data to say, what did we have as a result before? What are we getting as a result after? And has our interaction had an effect? Then you have to be mature enough to say, no, it's not having an effect, so we'll stop it. Or, wow, it's really having a great effect, let's do more. And that's where the resource comes in. Can we push more chips across the table on the things that are effective and take chips away, frankly, from the things that aren't?
Looking at an annual IT budget of over $3 billion, would you elaborate on how the department has strengthened its IT capital investment process to assure that investment decisions are mission-aligned and cost-justified, and what would remain to be done?
I think the way you strengthen the IT capital process is not think that it's a standalone process. So the problem with an IT capital process that is just an IT capital process is then it becomes disconnected from mission, it becomes disconnected from the broader resource discussion. IT is there to provide simpler, faster, better ways of delivering outcomes. It's the outcomes that are important. The IT is in service of that. And I think it's a mistake I've seen over and over in many of my different government jobs is that, and I frankly hear that it's a problem outside the government too, is that people think that the IT is the outcome. You know, that new system, that upgrade of this, that's the outcome. It really has to be posited and grounded in something you're trying to accomplish, something measurable, something that has a strong business case. And that's why the work, again, of Jeff Zients and Vivek Kundra around focusing on chunking our investments down into things that we can see, feel, and touch, and making business cases for each incremental investment, I think is such an important discipline to bring into the federal government. We've spent a lot of time, again, with Deputy Secretary Wollin, these quarterly reviews, asking the question about how can we deliver services more efficiently. And that question always comes back to what can we do in terms of our IT systems to make our interaction, say, with consumers simpler? How do we improve web interactions? How do we improve the business process? How do we reduce process steps? And so I think that the IT capital investment approach and process has to be really rooted in what you're trying to get as an outcome in the way of agency, of an agency. And as a result of that discussion, we have become increasingly concerned about the ratio of our IT spend that's on maintenance versus CapEx, that's on reinvestment. And I think that that is a bigger global, you know, red flare we have to set up for the federal government in general, particularly as we focus on additionally constrained resources. We need to make sure we don't crowd out the kind of modernization and systems improvements that are going to build us the kind of government that's going to let us win the future, that's going to let us be the government we need to have in the 21st century. So that's a bigger set of questions that we have to work at the OMB level, the cross-agency level, and certainly at the congressional level.
I think along the lines of, speaking of efficiencies, Treasury requires multiple data centers that are geographically dispersed and mutually supportive. Given your efforts around infrastructure modernization, would you elaborate on your continued data center consolidation efforts, the key challenges, the benefits, and making that happen?
Again, the data center consolidation, I think, again, huge props to Vivek Kundra and OMB for pushing this issue. I think it's a bigger issue. And this is kind of a very high-level specific example of it. And that is kind of the broader issue we have about real estate management in the federal government in general. We have 42 data centers that we identified in the Department of Treasury. And I say we identified because prior to this initiative led by OMB, we didn't have a definition, a common definition. We didn't have a number. If you had asked us how many we had, someone would have used their own assumptions and come up with some kind of number. Using the common assumptions, we've now been able to start benchmarking against other federal agencies. And that's really where I think collectively agencies can begin to improve the way they deliver services, is understanding the relative cost of one to the other, and then our cost versus the private sector. We have a plan to get down to 29, so 42 to 29 by 2015, but that's just a start. What we need to do is start better understanding how our systems interrelate, how our systems can work together, how we could maybe move some of our systems out of data centers that we own and control and into, you know, what they call the cloud. Are there overlapping systems? Are there ways that we can share our systems with others, like our HR Connect system we're working with? A couple other federal agencies to see if that's something that they can leverage. It's a bigger set of conversations, and it gets really interesting and really complex really fast. But it all comes down to, how do we deliver more efficient services for the federal taxpayer? How do we reduce the backshop footprint of our federal agencies? And how do we focus our bureaus and our components not on owning data centers, but actually managing data and delivering services?
Well, Dan, I want to talk about the ranking. I believe Treasury is ranked 12th recently on the best places to work
and going up.
It's one of the significant improvements. So it's actually, you mentioned earlier about the importance of people to the execution of your critical mission and the fact that the ranking for Treasury has increased year over year quite significantly. Would you elaborate on your efforts to improve hiring processes? And in particular, could you tell us about some of the key points related to the hiring reform initiative you're pursuing?
So I think hiring processes and hiring reform are one component of it, but I'd like to come back more to the ranking, because that's really about people who are there. Mm-hmm. You know, Secretary Geithner likes to say he grew up in the Treasury Department, that he essentially started his federal career there. He was there a long time, worked his way up from a career person to being the secretary. He's deeply committed to the institution. When I told him, listen, we are one of the top two agencies for increasing our relative position in the EVS ranking, I said, we went from 15th to 12th. He said, why aren't we number one? That is really the charge from, again, from Secretary Geithner. Deputy Secretary Wolin really works this issue with the bureaus. We are deeply committed to providing the environment that people will rank it as the number one agency to work. Now, we think our issues are, if they're not number one, they're tied for number one with some of the other big issues that the country are facing. And we think it's an amazing institution with tremendous history. And if you're going to be in public service, there are few other places where you can have as much of an impact. Now, what we need to do as organizational leaders is provide people that sense of connection, that sense of mission, and that sense that they are being supported in delivering those services. We want to keep the great people at the Treasury Department as long as we can, you know, we can keep them. You know, so we have to not just do a good job in hiring and recruiting, we need to do a good job in re-recruiting and retaining. And that means investing in people's skills, investing in training, investing in equipment, technology, investing in people's ideas, and finding ways that we can engage them in dialogue and give them a sense that they own a share in the Treasury Department and that they'll be committed to making it as good as it possibly can be. On the hiring side, that's a very important issue because of the the long talked about but soon arriving kind of demographic wave of retirement that we're going to see across the federal government. By some estimates, a third to a half of our people are eligible to retire in the next 5 years. The leadership class, the SES and the GS-15, those numbers come in a couple years. Those numbers are more dramatic in the 2, 3, 4 years. And so the question is, what are we doing to make sure that as we re-recruit and retain our current highly qualified employees, that we give them opportunities to move up, and then we're finding really smart and clever ways to reach out to expanding populations to give them opportunities in the Treasury Department and let them see what a cool place it is to work in the Treasury Department. Doing a lot of work with VA around hiring veterans, and we've had some great progress there, trying to expand opportunities for disabled Americans. And we've set one of the highest kind of results against our goals in that area. And I think that that's a really important effort, partnering up with the Office of Personnel Management and, again, OMB, to find ways that we can simplify the hiring process. We've done the Lean Six analysis of our hiring process, used data out of the our HR Connect system to find out where the process takes a long time. But one of the things we have to recognize is you can speed that process up. You can make it virtually instantaneous. The speed of the process isn't as important as the outcome. We want to have the highest quality, best fit people for our jobs. And so one of the things we are trying to do is get our hiring managers, get the people who are going to be accountable for working with those people, supporting those people, and getting the work product out and with those people involved, deeply involved in that process, and making sure that they own the outcome as well.
Now, you've mentioned data a couple of times, and it's interesting because I want to transition to the Open Government Directive, which is really asking the federal agencies to be transparent and get that data out there. And your department, Treasury, has really done a great job of doing that. And I believe it was the Leading Practices Award for Participation and Collaboration, if I'm correct. Would you tell us about some of the things you're doing in response to the Open Government Directive?
I think the Open Government Directive is just kind of the outward-facing set of questions that we've been asking internally. What do we know? What do we have in the way of information? And while we take it and try to turn it and twist it and look at it and so that we can try to answer the questions we have, we think we have a responsibility to provide data to the public so that they can do the same thing themselves. We just went through a big effort to redo our website, moving the hosting into the cloud, building this back-end system that actually allows for stronger collaboration, easier access of putting data onto the website. And one of the interesting parts about that is there is, right when you go to the homepage, I invite you to go to treasury.gov, there's what we call the data center, and that's where we're pushing as much data as we possibly can. We give kind of a graph of the week or a graph of the month so that people can see some of the ways we ask and answer questions. But then we try to make that a repository for providing information. We have a Web 2.0 component to it too, a Twitter feed, YouTube, so that not classic hard data tables and whatnot, but soft data in terms of kind of interactive description of everything that's happening in the Treasury Department at any given time, so people can kind of, you know, if you're a Treasury groupie, you can follow from home and try to give people some sense that this is their Treasury Department, that we possess their data. The data that's theirs and private, we're going to do everything we can to make sure it's private. So that's a big component of our open government effort, is actually also around data security and privacy. But that we also are going to try very hard to make data available to people, researchers, thoughtful people, journalists, that they can get a good sense of what's happening in an area that is so important and meaningful for everyone's daily life. As part of that, we focused, again, through a Lean Six Sigma process on improving our FOIA process. We think that that's really important, that people feel like there's a fair, transparent, and frankly, fast process for getting their logical petitions to their government answered and responded to. in a fair way. We've pushed down our FOIA backlog quite substantially. We are making investments around an enterprise content management system so that we have a stronger way of compiling in an electronic format that information that people will ask about. And we've created a FOIA reading room. We're working to make it possible for people to submit FOIA requests electronically. So you don't, no more faxing things back and forth, and we can have a dialogue with the way that, frankly, most people are having dialogues now around these things, although we will continue to accept U.S. Postal Service deliveries. And in trying to make sure that people feel a real sense of trust and faith that the Treasury Department will be as honest and open and transparent as it possibly can be. And we were pleased that we did receive a reward for our efforts around that.
What does the future hold for the U.S. Department of the Treasury? We will ask Dan Tinglerini, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Management and Chief Financial Officer, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The Open Government Directive called upon each federal agency to formulate a plan for how it intended to increase openness and public engagement in its programs and operations. The latest Senate report, An Open Government Implementation Model, Moving to Increase Public Engagement, provides a roadmap federal agencies can use to guide their efforts. You can order or download a free copy of this and all Senate reports at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. From contaminated peanut butter to spinach, our food safety net has shown signs of fraying, with tainted products slipping through to retail shelves, causing human harm and economic ruin. Pick up the latest Senate report on food safety and find out how critical private-public partnerships are enhancing the current food safety system in America. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. The U.S. workplace is undergoing a significant transition that presents uncharted territory and tremendous opportunity. The latest Senate report, Engaging a Multigenerational Workforce, Practical Advice for Government Managers, examines six trends now occurring in the workplace and describes how leaders can successfully manage through these trends and their challenges. These are the challenges of leading a multigenerational workforce and is increasingly driven by rapid technological changes that have changed the nature of work and how it gets done. You can order or download a free copy of this report and all Senate reports at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dan Tinglerini, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Management and Chief Financial Officer. Also joining us from IBM is Roxanne Ulrich. Dan, I talked to many of my guests about the use of collaboration and partnerships among agencies and with the private sector to achieve mission results. How are you leveraging partnerships to improve outcome?
I think that is really a real opportunity for the federal government in general is to find communities of common interest. The CIO Council, the CFO Council, the acquisition councils, these opportunities where really smart and talented people with certain areas of focus come together on a recurring basis are excellent opportunity for us to find ways that we can make the government collectively more efficient. Guys like Danny Werfel, the controller who owns the CFO Council responsibility, at least, he's done a lot to really work with the appointed CFOs, remind us of our accountability to the administration, to Congress, to the citizens, to deliver the best and most efficient government. It just so happens that, you know, my counterparts at the other agencies are really fantastic people. We challenge each other, and I've found that if I've had a question about XYZ, I can email those guys and get an answer back almost instantaneously about how they've confronted the problem, how they've dealt with it. And, you know, I think we have to realize that we are in this together, that these challenges are not, as much as we like to think each one of our agencies is so unique and special, we share a lot of the same common issues and that we can solve them together. And I think what's a lot of fun are finding opportunities that we can work together across agencies, working with VA on issues of, say, office supply procurement. And in doing these very specific activities, we can learn maybe some moves that we can then expand more broadly across government. Working with Martha Johnson at GSA around strategic sourcing really came out of a number of conversations we were having among the agencies of how frustrated we are that we buy the same thing over and over within the agency, never mind between agencies. Martha's response is, well, I've got that. That's, you know, that's my job. That's our responsibility. Let's see how we can overcome some of those challenges. And then Jeff Zients has been a really powerful thought leader in connecting government with the private sector and having us have an opportunity to learn lessons that, you know, frankly, they've learned the hard way and the easy way.
Given Treasury's critical mission, your office requires staff with technical skills, expertise, and very diverse competencies. And I know, Dan, you talked a little bit about that in the previous segment. But to that end, what are you doing to ensure you have a well-trained and technical workforce able to meet both the challenges of today and opportunities of tomorrow?
That's a great question. And if I can answer it first with a little story. Someone came and visited me at the main Treasury building, and it's such an amazing building. And we actually give tours of the building on Saturday, so go to the treasury.gov website. It's a little secret. I've probably ruined it now. And I was showing someone around the building, and what's really fascinating about the building is it's not just a headquarters building. It was a factory. We printed the bills there. We stored coins. It was a bank. You used to be able to bring bills in and trade them for gold. And so we have vaults, and we have bars on the windows, and we, you know, all this history there. And I think it was just the sheer number of vaults and this real sense that, you know, that maybe the name, the Treasury. He asked me, he said, well, what is the most valuable thing you have in this building? What is the most expensive? What's the most costly thing, you know? And he was expecting me to tell him that there was a big vault with gold bars in the basement. And I pointed as we were walking down the hall. I said, that's it right there. And he said, what? And a person walked by. I said, that's the most valuable thing we have at the Treasury Department is these people here. These are really smart people, many of whom have opportunities. They could do anything. They could do it anywhere. They choose to do it for the American people. They choose to do it the United States Department of Treasury. That is an incredible responsibility. It's one, again, as I said, the Secretary reinforced on the first day I walked in the building that we are stewards of a very, very, very important, meaningful, and incredibly valuable institution. And what we need to do is continue to invest in those folks and give them some sense that they've made the right decision to serve the people in this capacity, because there are other ways they could serve too. And so that's, I think, the biggest challenge for us as leaders in the organization, to continually find ways that we can support the folks who do that incredibly important mission.
Turning just to the CFO's role for a moment, given the critical and strategic importance financial information plays in mission and program delivery, what is your view of the CFO's role in helping an agency drive down cost, respond to tighter budgets? What actions do you think a CFO can take?
I think it's not just a CFO's role. I think that that's their primary responsibility. It's great to be a CFO at the Treasury Department because everyone's kind of a CFO, you know, at some level there. I mean, everyone is very concerned about the bottom line. You don't have to fight for mind share on the bottom line at the Treasury Department. You know, sometimes you have to, you know, fight for your interpretation of it, right? And that's the downside where everyone else has a real, you know, frankly, some people have really very deep experience on this. So I think, though, with the CFO Act, you know, the 20th anniversary of the CFO Act just recently behind us, I think that our responsibility as CFOs have now evolved now that we're into the third decade. Our first job was to really create financial management structures for the federal government. And it's kind of appalling to think that there weren't meaningful ones. They weren't much different than this little book here from 1842. This was in 1991. So that has been really our big, you know, Herculean task for the last couple of decades. And now we have to start providing that data in such a way that it can actually support decisions.